We live on an ocean planet. For every acre of dry land, Earth has over 2.5 acres of ocean. Seawater is salty, but some ocean regions are more salty than others. And the pattern of saltiness, the pattern of salinity, can tell us things about our planet, including how the climate is evolving. We've measured the sea's salt for centuries from ships, and more recently with robot buoys. But the ocean is huge, ships and buoys few and far between. Fortunately, we can now measure salinity from space. Just looking at a spoon or a fork, you can tell what they're made of, whether it's a silver spoon or a plastic fork. Silver conducts electricity, plastic does not. And the same subatomic arrangements that make silver and plastic conductors or insulators affect how they interact with electromagnetic radiation, with light, with radio, with microwaves, which is why we can see what they're made of with our eyes. Pure water is a poor electrical conductor, but add salt and water conducts. The more salt, the better it conducts. And as it gets saltier, along with changes in conductivity, comes a change in the way water interacts with electromagnetic radiation, especially microwaves. We launch rockets out over the Atlantic and into space from Florida, but only if we want the spacecraft to orbit Earth from west to east. When we want a spacecraft to orbit from north to south, we launch it out over the Pacific, from Vandenberg Air Force Base in Southern California. In June of 2011, my sweetie and I drove down to Vandenberg to watch a Delta II launch vehicle hurl an Argentine spacecraft, El Satélite de Aplicaciones Científicas, into orbit. Bolted into the spacecraft was a microwave radiometer, part of the American Aquarius mission, to measure microwave radiation coming up off the ocean, and thereby to measure ocean salinity. It was at the launch that I was able to meet up with Dr. Gary Lagerlof, principal investigator, point man for the Aquarius mission. Before that, Lagerlof and I had only spoken by phone and email. I recently resumed our phone conversations and started out asking him to describe what Aquarius sees when the largest river in the world, the Amazon, carries a huge pulse of fresh water into the salty Atlantic.
When we got that first image in September of 2011, we could see a pattern of fresh water coming out of the Amazon. Now that we have a year's worth of data, we can actually see how it varies.
It doesn't just flow straight out of the river. Sometimes it flows to the east towards Africa. Most of the time, it seems to make an immediate bend north.
Early in the season, most of the fresh water flows northward into the Caribbean. But as we get into late summer, the intertropical convergence zone is farther north of the equator.
The intertropical convergence zone, where the trade winds of the northern hemisphere meet the trade winds of the southern hemisphere, you get tremendous thunderstorms there, which is why we have rainforests. It also changes the currents, the ocean currents.
The trade winds converge there, so they affect the surface circulation. The winds that accompany that convergence zone, particularly in that region between the equator and about 10 degrees north, and that's where you see the Amazon River starts to flow eastward across the ocean. And the winds change and the currents change, and that fresh water gets caught up in the North Equatorial Current System. That water then is advected eastward across the North Atlantic Ocean. The other thing that's important about the intertropical convergence zone is that this is where hurricanes are formed. As these tropical storms develop, they get a lot of energy from the ocean by evaporating water off the sea surface. It provides energy to the hurricanes.
One of the cool things about physics is that you can almost always do the same trick backwards. When water evaporates off our skin, when it goes from liquid to gas, it sucks up energy and cools us off. When water condenses to form raindrops, it goes from gas to liquid. It releases energy and warms things up around it. That released energy, it's called latent heat. That is the main source of energy that spins up a hurricane.
What we're finding out from looking at these data is that the hurricanes move westward. They encounter the fresh water from the Amazon River plume, and that fresh water lands at the surface is usually warmed up by the sun. So the hurricanes are actually picking up extra energy from that fresh water, and as they pass over that, the wind from the hurricanes themselves will mix that surface fresh water down. So we'll see a trace in the Aquarius data of high salinity after the hurricane has gone by. And this gives us an indication about how much extra heat energy the hurricane has actually picked up.
Hurricanes are essentially tropical thunderstorms that have been entangled with one another. So you get a number of storms, all their energy pumping into one giant system, the hurricane.
Yeah, that's a pretty good description of it. They start off as what's called a tropical depression in the eastern part of the tropical Atlantic Ocean. And due to the trade winds, they migrate towards the west. As they move along, they get more energy by evaporating water off the sea surface, and then the low-pressure system intensifies in the middle. If you look at the details of a hurricane, like you said, it looks like a combination of lots of strong thunderstorms inside this larger organized system, and that's essentially what a hurricane is. Hurricanes don't grow unless the surface temperatures are above a certain threshold of about 27, 28 degrees Celsius.
81, 82 degrees Fahrenheit.
They need that heat in the upper ocean in order to gain strength. What we're finding out is that the interaction of this low salinity water coming out of the Amazon, which is also quite warm, could have an effect on hurricane development.
The word lens comes from the same root as lentil. Lenses are shaped like lentil seeds.
Right.
And here you've got this lens of fresh water. It's like a pond instead of a pond on land. Mm-hmm. It's a pond of fresh water in the middle of the ocean.
Sometimes we also call it a plume. The water that flows out of the river is lower salinity. It's fresh water, so it's of lower density, and it tends to stay on the surface for quite a long time. And just because of the sheer volume of the Amazon and Orinoco rivers, you see this plume extending hundreds of kilometers, even thousands of kilometers away from shore. And it takes time for the ocean to mix that fresh water in with the surrounding salty water. From looking at the very surface with the satellite data, we can see the signature for a long time.
And like any pond, if you will, sitting in the sun, it warms up.
It warms up. There's a shallow stratification. The fresh water is only a few meters deep. And so that surface layer picks up the sunlight first, and it warms up the most.
The opposite of that fresh water sitting on the surface, you look at the North Atlantic, big stretch of the ocean between North America and Africa. It is salty.
That region in the North Atlantic is the saltiest area of the open ocean. The primary explanation is that the Atlantic Ocean loses more fresh water to the atmosphere through evaporation than it receives in rainfall and river runoff. So the Atlantic Ocean is constantly losing fresh water to the atmosphere, and so we find higher salinities in the Atlantic than we do in the other ocean basins. In this particular region, we have a combination of evaporation and ocean circulation that allow the highest salinities to appear in these latitudes right around 24 degrees north latitude.
Same latitudes where we find Earth's major deserts on land. Same reason, lots of evaporation, very little rain.
Precisely. If you look along the same latitudes, you'll find the driest areas in the Sahara, straight east of this area. The reason that these areas are dry have to do with the large-scale circulation in the atmosphere. Upper atmospheric motion converges and sinks down towards the surface at these latitudes, and that brings down very dry air. All around the globe, essentially, you have much lower humidity in these regions. We actually mounted a field experiment there last year, fall of 2012, to go out and take a number of measurements to really explore this region to understand better what are the physical processes that keep this salinity as high as it is. The salinities that we were observing during that cruise were actually at the highest levels that had been observed in that area up until this time. We know from measurements taken here in this area over the last 3 or 4 decades, the salinity at the surface has been gradually increasing in this region. We take this as evidence that evaporation is increasing in this area, and that's a sign that the global water cycle is actually intensifying. So we're finding more evaporation in areas like this, which are typically arid, and more precipitation falling in other parts of the ocean where rainfall dominates. We see this as an intensification of the cycling of water. And this is the kind of thing that we expect to see with global warming. So this is an important thing to continue to study with the data from this instrument.
You now have a year's worth of data. What surprises have come up? What did you not expect?
First of all, it's very dynamic. It changes a lot during the season. And we can really watch the details of it from the instrument. And we can also start to do some calculations about when we see a hurricane go across that plume, we can look at the changes in the salinity before and after the hurricane and learn something about what it does to the upper ocean. So those are unique things that we never really anticipated seeing.
Hurricanes churn up that deeper water, which is not only saltier, it's also colder.
Right. They do leave a cold water wake in their path. That cold water wake is actually an indicator of how much heat they've extracted from the ocean, which adds to the hurricane's energy.
I'm speaking with Dr. Gary Lagerlöf. He is senior scientist and president of Earth and Space Research and principal investigator for the Aquarius mission.
Another area that's been very surprising is in the tropical Pacific Ocean, particularly in the eastern tropical Pacific.
And now here we're talking the very opposite of the Atlantic. The Atlantic, North Atlantic, is very, very salty. The eastern tropical Pacific is not nearly as salty.
The Atlantic loses more moisture to the atmosphere than it regains in rainfall and rivers. A lot of that moisture is carried by the trade winds, and it crosses over Central America and then falls in the Pacific Ocean. So the eastern tropical Pacific is actually diluted quite a bit, in contrast.
By Atlantic Ocean water.
Some of that is Atlantic Ocean water, yes. We're seeing some interesting things happening in the eastern Pacific. There's a pool of fresh water just west of the Isthmus of Panama that we've known oceanographically for some time, but now that we have the satellite data, we can really see how it varies over the year. It tends to build up towards the end of the year and in November, December, January, and then it starts to dissipate later on in the year. Some of the fresh water moves north and some moves south. It seems to be a way that the ocean is conveying some of this fresh water into the rest of the circulation that we don't really understand yet, but there's been some really interesting things to observe there. We've also found long, what we call planetary waves, in the signatures of the salinity data.
Planetary waves, these are waves that are moving across the ocean from east to west, and they're waving, if you will, north and south.
Right. They're wave-like patterns in the ocean currents. They're not like surface waves that you experience when you're out in your boat.
Which go up and down.
Which go up and down. These go kind of north and south. As it moves across the ocean, it zigzags from north to south. We have documented, none of this has been published yet, but we have documented that we can see fresh water which accumulates in the western Pacific. We can see it moving eastward as we move into more of an El Nino-type condition.
That fresh water is coming out of all the thunderstorms over the western Pacific, over Indonesia and that area.
Precisely. That's right. Yeah. That area over Indonesia is one of the wettest areas on Earth. It's about 5 meters of rainfall a year that falls on the ocean in that part of the world.
That's like 16, 17 feet.
Yeah, it's a lot of water.
I was able to join you for the launch of the Aquarius mission back in 2011. Since then, we've gone into and gone out of a La Nina event. Have you been able to watch the change in ocean salinity due to La Nina?
We have, but the signal has not been very strong. It would have been nice if it had been a really strong event. During 2012, there was started to look like an El Nino was evolving, taking us out of a La Nina phase, and then it fizzled out and we went back into a La Nina phase. So we don't have as much of a contrast from one to the other that we would like to see. We do have some measurements of what the salinity patterns are like during a La Nina phase. We're sort of in a neutral phase right now, but for much of the past year, it's been in a La Nina phase.
And you still have a couple of years left in this mission where we can
hope
for.
We do. We hope we have many years left in this mission. But the prime mission goes for 3 years, and that will end at the end of 2014. We're about halfway through that. We're another year and a half of observations to go.
So the chances are good that you will see an El Nino.
I think so. And that will be really exciting when we do.
You can actually watch the Arctic ice melt because that fresh water, ice water, flows into the Atlantic.
In principle, you're correct. The problem is that what we can see in the data, of course, you can see where the ice is and where it's not. The problem is that making the measurements in the vicinity of the ice and in the vicinity of the coastline is very difficult. It's difficult right now, at least, to document where that fresh water is going as the ice melts.
That's because ice and land are very bright in microwaves.
So they contaminate the signal over the ocean that we're trying to measure. And it's going to take some research before we can pull those two signatures apart and be able to give information just about what's happening in the ocean.
You're getting glare. It's kind of like trying to see something in a dark corner.
Exactly, yep.
Like trying to see something in a dark corner when there's a bright light off on the edge of your field of view.
But I'm confident that in time we will be able to see that. And exploring the changes in the Arctic is going to turn out to be a very important thing that we'll do with this mission later on. One of the long-range problems that I'm really interested in working on, and we're getting close to be able to make some good calculations about that now, is the relationship between changes in the ocean salinity from one part of the ocean to the other and how that links to changes in rainfall. We have rainfall data from other kinds of satellite measurements, and now we're working on tying those to what we're seeing in the changes of salinity. We have to link that to ocean circulation as well. So there's lots of pieces that have to be pulled in order to do those kinds of calculations. It's really important to get an overall comprehensive understanding of the coupling between the global water cycle and ocean circulation and climate variability. That's one of the prime reasons we proposed this mission, and I think we're on the verge of coming up with some really good scientific results about that.
It sounds a little chicken and egg there. Are you trying to correlate how much rainfall you get over the ocean, which then dilutes the salinity, or are you saying that the salinity of the ocean affects how much rainfall you get?
The rainfall is going to affect the surface salinity, but the feedback is that as you change surface salinity, the density of seawater changes, and that influences ocean circulation. Those changes in the ocean circulation then influence how the ocean transports heat. That heat then feeds back into the atmosphere, and that affects the atmospheric circulation and the rainfall patterns. So there's a coupling process going on between the ocean and the atmosphere, but it's quite complicated. It goes through several stages.
Back in September of 2011, Tropical Storm Lee blew over New Orleans, and you can see the squirt of fresh water coming out of the Mississippi. As a result, you get this pulse of fresh water into the Gulf of Mexico. We're talking on Thursday. USGS has just announced that the Mississippi has peaked at St. Louis. So in a few days, that water should reach the Gulf. Do you expect to see that?
Actually, yeah, that's a very good point. Some of those early images that we saw in September of 2011 showed that freshwater signature. And at first, we didn't really give it too much credit because we knew about these other problems of trying to measure the salinity close to the shoreline, but it was a very robust feature, and it faded away in a matter of about 2 weeks, and it was clearly tied with the timing of Hurricane Lee, which crossed over New Orleans right around the first week or so of September. So I think you're right. There's a good chance that we'll see a freshwater signature in the Gulf of Mexico when the river finishes cresting. And then if we have any tropical storms this coming season that go through the Gulf of Mexico, I think we're going to see the same sort of thing again.
Gary, it's really been fun talking with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Al. It's been a real pleasure.
I've been speaking with Dr. Gary Lagerlof. He is senior scientist and president of Earth and Space Research and principal investigator for the Aquarius mission flying aboard the Argentine spacecraft Satellite de Aplicaciones Científicas. I want to emphasize what a delicate measurement Aquarius is performing. Pop a slice of bread into the toaster, and the toaster wires get hot enough to glow in the red part of the electromagnetic spectrum. A wood stove also glows, but it's not as hot as a toaster, not hot enough to give off visible light, so a wood stove glows in the infrared part of the spectrum. Electromagnetic energy we can feel as heat. You and I glow too, but we're not even as hot as a wood stove, so we glow down in the microwave part of the spectrum. And that's where the ocean glows, in microwaves. Unfortunately, the microwave region is a pretty noisy part of the spectrum, what with radar and microwave ovens and cell phones and communication towers blasting out microwaves 24/7. If we could see microwaves, we'd see ourselves bathed in electromagnetic noise, noise that's way louder than the signal Aquarius is trying to pick up from the ocean. Fortunately, there's one frequency that's protected, one wavelength that's been set aside, one wavelength used by no one. Having mapped our cities, our states, our countries, our planet, our solar system, now we're mapping our galaxy. The vast bulk of the galaxy's matter is hydrogen gas. To map the galaxy, we look for places where hydrogen is lurking. We can find that hydrogen because hydrogen atoms give off microwaves. Microwaves of a very specific frequency of signature wavelength. That one wavelength has been set aside by international agreement. No one can touch it. No country, no corporation, no army or navy can transmit at this one wavelength. And it's that unpolluted frequency, 1.413 gigahertz, 1,413 million vibrations per second, that Aquarius picks up from the ocean. For KVMR, I'm Al Stoller.